Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. No final segment of Beastly Business can fail to acknowledge the tremendous debt of gratitude to those who contributed to this book, finally finding its way into print and audio versions. Patricia Smith, then at the University of Pennsylvania Press, encouraged me to write for myself rather than to please editors, and also to write something completely new and different. Ken Goddard, director of the National Fish and Wildlife Forensic Laboratory, provided technical and literary support at a time I needed it the most. Encouragement from Stephanie Lafarge, Director of Counseling Services for the New York ASPCA, also meant a great deal to me because her understanding of the full spectrum of the human-animal bond is so profound. A special thanks goes to my sons Jeremy and Dan, who not only support my every project, no matter how crazy, but also shepherd me through the world of computers and cyberspace with saintly patience. Jeremy's confidence that I could clean up and reformat a manuscript that had been written on so many different machines using so many different WordPerfect and Word Program versions I couldn't remember them all, inspired me to do just that. But I couldn't have done it had I not known that both he and Dan were always there if I needed help. I don't need any reasons, but if I did, this would be yet another one for loving them more than I can say. I'd like to say that I'd so mastered recording by the time I finished the audio version of Getting Fixed that I sailed through Beastly Business with nary a problem. Alas, such was not the case. Although I did learn to adjust the headset so it more or less wouldn't put yet another dent in my skull, and I did avoid recording during the Canary's daily song fests, I encountered other technological and animal-related challenges. Among the technological was an annoying click I could hear in the recording. In an attempt to eliminate it, I put the laptop and the headset connection to it on a thick towel, thinking the cable was hitting the desk when I talked. When that didn't work, I decided the noise must be the result of the cable hitting a button or zipper on my clothing. All such garments were eliminated from my recording wardrobe. Still, the click persisted. Growing desperate, I resorted to naked recording to banish the pesky noise once and for all. That didn't eliminate the click, but it did make me feel very foolish and thankful yet again that I have no close neighbors. Having eliminated the connection with the computer and myself as the source of the diabolical sound, I did what I should have done in the first place. I examined the headset in minute detail. When I did, I discovered that when I moved my head a certain way, it caused the earpieces to move the hard plastic ball joint between them and the headband and produced the click. To put an end to that, I stuffed the open space in the joints with cotton and tried to limit any movement when I spoke. Aside from the wisps of cotton sprouting from both earpieces making me look like a Shih Tzu from outer space, it's not easy for someone who uses a lot of body language when she talks to hold still when recording. It was a good exercise in self-control, and did eliminate most of the clicks. But a new headset is on the want list. Dealing with the clicks was a chronic technological problem, but I experienced one major technological crisis I'm almost too embarrassed to admit. One day I turned on my computer and caught up the chapter I was working on. A horrific silence greeted me. To say that I went berserk is putting it mildly. I checked the headset and all of its settings and connections. Then I did the same to my audio program. Because the audio program has a gazillion settings and uses terminology that still remains either confusing or unknown to me, for example, I still have no idea what dribbling means in audio terms, this exercise left me more upset than ever. At that point, I dialed one of my two emergency computer hotlines, this one belonging to Dan, because I just called Jeremy the day before about some other computer crisis related to a different program. I try to be an equal opportunity pain-in-the-butt mom. Being well brought up, Dan patiently listened to me blabber about the catastrophe that, in addition to driving me mad, had destroyed my life's work, etc., etc. Periodically, he even asked me questions that created the illusion that I was right. The computer was possessed by evil forces totally beyond my control. Then he asked the question, the one he and his brother have asked me numerous times when computer disaster strikes, but which I always forget in my panic. "Did you try rebooting it?" he asked respectfully. Of course I hadn't. Why would I do something so simple and obvious as that when I could get myself worked up into a full-blown snit? So I rebooted the computer and the sound magically returned. Still hoping to salvage some shred of dignity from yet another pitiful display of cyber ineptitude, I asked Dan why this happened, and that precipitated another familiar exchange. "Your computer's old, Mom." "What?" I squawked. "It's only 3 years old. It's still a baby." I could see him rolling his eyes upward as he once again reminded me that computers are already old when we buy them, and it's downhill from there. I thanked him for his help, added new computer to my want list, and went back to recording. Before I discuss the animal-related aspect of recording beastly business, seems like a good time to mention its epigram. It's one of my favorite human-animal bond quotes, and it captures the essence of a theme that recurs throughout the ages. What is man without the beasts? If all the beasts were gone, men would die of great loneliness of spirit. For whatever happens to the beasts also happens to the man. As far as I'm concerned, Chief Seattle nailed it when he said that back in 1855. That innate emotional connection between humans and animals became especially clear to me when I was recording the more emotionally charged dialogue in Beastly Business. Being a somewhat reserved person myself, it took a fair amount of effort for me to communicate even some of the anger or fear that I wanted to convey in certain verbal exchanges. Having finally mustered the courage to do that, seeing the result destroyed when the dogs thought we were under attack and started barking frantically and racing downstairs to check out all accessible doors and windows for intruders was discouraging, to say the least. Other times I'd be happily lost in my own little recording world, unmindful that the dogs were playing with their toys or each other, only to discover that my shouted "Stop!" or "No!" froze them in place. And naturally, every time this happened, Wit, the cat, who I'm now sure resides in a very special place in feline heaven, would shoot out from his hiding place and streak down the stairs. As soon as he did that, the dogs would start barking again and race after him, in case he knew something that they didn't. Truth be told, Wit always knew a lot of things they didn't, but that's a different story. Believe it or not, I eventually discovered that if I told the dogs what I was going to be doing before I did it, they were more accepting. As a result, periodically I would stop in my reading to say something like, "All right, heads up, everyone. I'm going to say something that sounds really angry next, and I want to remind you that this has nothing to do with you whatsoever, so there's no need to make a sound. Anyone who does will deeply regret it." The animal's acceptance of this, unfortunately, didn't extend to the editing phase. It was as if they would forgive one Cry Wolf episode, but not the repeated ones that sometimes occurred as I cleaned up a section. To eliminate those canine and feline outbursts, I could have edited and used a headset and turned the volume up as loud as I wanted. But, as you know, the headset and I have a love-hate relationship at best. Even so, hearing barely audible words supposedly uttered by a variety of angry or mad people was sufficiently disorienting that I ultimately opted for a dented head. As always when I finish a book, regardless in what form, there's a sense of loss, kind of like sending your kid out into the world. There are more books in the Sinclair McCarthy series, but I need to do some revising because it's been a while since I wrote them. Because I can only do that in free time, and sometimes I don't have a lot of that, it might be a while before the next one is in recordable form. In the meantime, since memoirs are so hot, I'm thinking about recording a memoir I wrote that already is, as they used to say in Hollywood, in the can. Thanks for listening to Beastly Business. Stay tuned, and may any feelings of loneliness of spirit be soothed by your awareness of the animal life around you. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery, written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.